Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Bill Plake, who is an Alexander Technique teacher in South Pasadena, which is in the LA area. He is also a critically acclaimed musician. He plays saxophone and flute. He has worked a lot with musicians in his teaching. He has a very active blog on the general topic, the Alexander Technique and musicians. We'll put a link to his website by the interview, and you can access his blog that way. And today we're going to talk about what the Alexander Technique has to offer to musicians. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Robert. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you on the show. I've been reading your blogs over the last year or so, and obviously you have a lot of very, very useful insights into teaching musicians, how musicians think, and how the Alexander Technique can help them. Before we talk about that sort of thing, could you begin by just giving our listeners a short description of the Alexander Technique?
Well, I look at the Alexander Technique as a method of self-care primarily. Also could be looked at as a practical method of education that aims at teaching people to become aware of and prevent unnecessary muscular tension as they carry out their activities. So it's something that supports good balance and coordination, an improved sensory awareness, better use of the voice and breathing, and ease and efficiency in movement.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty much useful for anyone who wants to do things more easily or with less strain. And, of course, it does have quite a long history of helping people with various stress-related ailments like back pain and neck pain and so on. But in terms of musicians, what are the special advantages that it holds out to musicians?
Well, I would say two. I mean, first of all, as you mentioned, many professional musicians are plagued with chronic pain. It's not unusual for them to be in their 30s, not getting even younger now, and experiencing pain to the point where they're not able to work even. So, of course, it's wonderful for that, for helping them to rethink their instrument, to rethink what they do so that they're not creating this kind of pain. And the bigger bonus from a very creative point of view and an expressive and artistic point of view is that it helps musicians to become aware of their habitual thinking when it comes to playing music, so that they're able to, rather than go out each time and sort of recreate what they've done before, they're able to go out each time and take a step into the unknown, which of course is, in my opinion, a lot of the whole aim of the Alexander Technique, is being able to step into the unknown with confidence. And they're able to do that much better through implementing the principles of the Alexander Technique.
Mm-hmm. And when you say recreating their habitual approach to playing or singing, could you elaborate a little on that? What, maybe giving an example or two of what you mean by that?
Yeah, sure. You know, as musicians, we sort of fall into a trap because we sort of have an idea of what it feels like to play well. And because of that, very often we get up and we're aiming for this feeling of what it feels like to play well. And of course, the trap is that when we finally gain that feeling of what it feels like when we play well, very often it does is because it's we're playing in a very habitual way. So our sound is backed into this kind of narrow box that we put it in. Our conception of interpretation is back into this narrow box. I'm primarily an improvisational musician, and you know, I play jazz and other kinds of improvised music. And most of the musicians that I work with, I would say more than half are improvising musicians as well. And improvising musicians, because we also have to create the music on the spot, besides, you know, interpreting it and playing it and everything else, I notice more and more that improvising musicians tend to be enslaved by their own body gestures. In fact, if you were to go, say, on YouTube and watch certain musicians, and turn the sound completely off and just watch them 8 or 9 times in a row, you're going to see kind of what I call a repertoire of stereotypical movement patterns that they make in their expression. And then if you were to go roll back about the 9th or 10th time and actually turn the sound up, you'll see that even though supposedly they're improvising, that it is their physical gestures and their tensions that are the things that are preceding what's coming out of their instrument. So to me, it begs the question of what is influencing what? Is the physical gesture and tension the thing that's influencing the creativity? Or is the physical gesture and tension something that's a result of the creative impulse? And if it's the first, if it's the physical gesture preceding the creativity, well, as you might guess, that really limits our creativity, because we tend to go down the same tension and movement and thinking patterns all the way around. And even though we feel like we're improvising, very often what we're doing when we do that is we're just sort of rehashing the past and maybe with maybe some variations on it, but not much.
Right. Now, I can see how a musician who is an improvisational musician, like such as you are, I can see that what you say would resonate with them. But how about a musician who's not an improvisational one? They just want to play the standard repertoire, or sing the standard repertoire well. Could you say a little more about what the problem is with going for the habitual feeling for them?
Well, and yes, of course, in many ways, it's the same thing. It's just a question of degrees. I think that actually all musicians are improvisational musicians, whether they're making up the music or not. I mean, if you go and listen to classical music and you listen to 10 great performances of the same piece, you're going to hear 10 very different versions of that piece. And even in the great artists, you know, people like Rubinstein and people like Heifetz, if you were to hear them night after night, you would hear a different version of each piece that they played, because they were open to that kind of change. Contrast that to other classical musicians whose performances just almost sound locked in, being the same performance after performance after performance. And again, when you watch these musicians, you tend to see the same patterns of tension that they bring in from performance to performance. And it's the same kind of principles. That tension that they bring into the playing limits their capacity to take chances with the music, to think more broadly about the music, to imagine the music in a different way. All these things, to take risks, to do all the things that are necessary to be truly spontaneous in a performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm an Alexander teacher who happens to work quite a bit with musicians as well, although I have almost zero musical ability or background. So I can't always hear the things that you're talking about. But what I see with a lot of musicians is the very thing you talked about, they have some idea about what it should feel like to begin to play their instrument or to begin to sing. And often that involves creating some tension or holding. Or you'll see singers a lot who you could be talking to them and they're fine, and then suddenly it's time for them to sing and they do a little stiffening up or some little thing that in their mind is connected with singing. So maybe it would be useful. There is this Alexander technique idea that our feelings, our physical sensations, are not always the best guide to how we should organize ourselves. Could you say a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I'm trying to sneak you into that.
Well, let me say this first of all, while it's on my mind. You mentioned that you don't hear some of these things, and I'm going to tell you, of course, and as you know this, you don't have to hear those things when you're teaching the Alexander technique, but you can see these things.
You can see them very clearly.
Very clearly, right, yeah. And that's the main thing. Yes, so going by our physical sensations is typically not a good thing to go by. It's the very thing that in my own life led me to the very problems that brought me to studying the Alexander technique, because what it felt like to play, what I believed, and we go back to this idea of false belief, what I believed it took to play the saxophone well was I believed that it took me to tighten up my abdominal area to an incredible degree, lift the left side of my hip, pick my left shoulder up, lock my head down into my shoulders, and to stiffen my legs. And that's what felt right to me. When I was getting my sound, that's what felt right to me. And of course, as I began to study the technique, I began to learn rather quickly that none of that stuff was necessary. In fact, probably the best saxophone lesson I've ever had in my life was from my first Alexander teacher, Francis Marsden, who simply watched me play the saxophone and began to, she knew nothing about it, of course, and she just simply began to ask me questions. Is this necessary? Is that necessary? And she didn't know. She literally was trying to understand what it took to play. And that was an eye-opener to me because, no, of course, this isn't necessary. It's not necessary for me to do this with my shoulder. So if we get to a point where we're not relying upon our feelings as much, if that's not the thing we're aiming for, what we begin to open ourselves up to is the possibility in instrumental performance, and of course this applies to any activity, but we're talking now about instrumental performance or musical performance, we're opening ourselves up to the possibility in the idea of understanding more clearly cause and effect. What causes what? And one of the things that I sometimes, when I teach my classes of musicians, I very often want to get this across in their mind. Is when I'll show different images of great musicians playing, classical musicians and jazz musicians, and you'll see some people looking beautiful and others putting themselves into a mess. And I like to get this idea along. If you look at a great trumpet player like Miles Davis, for example, who when he plays was a mess. I mean, hip thrust forward, head pulled back, you know, everything that you could possibly do wrong. Yet he played beautifully. So we have to say, in the case of Miles Davis, he played beautifully despite what he did, not because of what he did. Because you'll have a certain amount of trumpet players watching Miles Davis, and they'll say, okay, to get that sound, I need to do what he did. And they'll throw themselves in that same pattern of tension. And of course, that's not at all necessary to get that sound. You know, again, he was able to do that despite all this horrible tension that he created. And if you can contrast that with, say, somebody like Heifetz, who, when you watch him play, was beautifully upright and moved into length and expansion. I mean, he moved. He contracted and he expanded, but his default was always this upward and outward expansion. You watch somebody like that play, and it becomes clear that he's playing well because he's supported by what he's doing in his gesture. You know, he's supported by all this. And so I don't think the Heifetz, I don't know what he was looking for, but I don't think he was looking for a feeling when he was playing. I think he was simply allowing his muse to lead his mind, his senses, and his body into playing in a very expansive, easy, and always spontaneous way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so obviously one of your jobs as an Alexander Technique teacher is to help your students learn not to rely on their feelings for as a guide to how to organize themselves, but more on their thinking, let's say, or their way of self-directing. But, you know, in our world today, that goes against a lot of sort of conventional wisdom. If it feels right, it is right. How do you approach that with musicians in particular?
Well, as you mentioned, I continually with them try to get them to not ignore their feelings, but to reframe their feelings. And musicians are particularly serious musicians. If they're going to change and they want to change, they want to feel what it feels like to play. They want to feel when it's right. Okay, oh, so this is what it feels like. So what I try to get them with I sort of approach it in two ways. And one, I get them to understand cause and effects, the physics of producing sound, and are they with their physical gestures working in accordance with those physics? In other words, this is an objective kind of thing. This is, you know, your hands are doing this. Is it helping the situation or is it not helping? And then the other thing, rather than trying to emphasize them to try to feel what's right, I'm working on getting them to recognize when they feel something that's wrong. In other words, they start to sense when they're locking their knees, or they start to sense when they're pulling their head back, or they start to sense when they're picking their shoulder up. And I get them to certainly notice these things in terms of sensation. But once they notice that thing, it's to simply direct themselves out of it. Say, okay, so I'm going to choose not to do that. And then bring their attention out through their senses again, out through their eyes, out through their ears, and not focus on the body part. Because as you probably know in your experience with working with musicians, they tend to really bring all their attention down to what they think is the trouble area or the crucial area at the expense of letting their attention sort of come out and be inclusive of their environment and inclusive of all their senses and their body as well.
Well, and not just musicians. I mean, that's pretty generally true.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you mentioned, I think you used the term the physics of producing, and that leads me to ask you, there is a sort of a subset of the Alexander technique called body mapping.
Uh-huh.
You can find elements of that. That in Alexander's own writings, and it has been developed quite a bit. Do you find it useful when you're working with musicians to bring that information to bear?
Absolutely. I find it extremely helpful, and now it seems to be really integrated into what I do, and really I consider essential. Body mapping on its own, that is just understanding the size, the shape, the function of the joint, the location of the joint, these things. This is important information. It in itself isn't always complete to help people, though, because we're still faced with, as you mentioned earlier, this faulty sensory awareness. We may know clearly where the joint is. We may know clearly how it works. But the moment we begin to put that instrument towards our face or pick up that bow or something like that, we jump right into our habit again. And that's, of course, the only way that can be addressed is through awareness and inhibition and direction. That's where the Alexander technique comes in squarely. But it ties in beautifully with body mapping. I think that, for me, body mapping has been very helpful in this way.
Right. I would agree. I mean, I think body mapping by itself, it can achieve some pretty amazing things, but the real power of the Alexander technique is learning how to basically self-direct yourself out of whatever messes you've gotten yourself into. I mean, that's I think is the power. It's interesting. I did a interview with another teacher a few months ago who works a lot with musicians also, and she pointed out that most musicians really have no idea of how they're organized physically. They don't know where key joints are or how they operate. And the only musicians that do have maps typically are singers, but their maps are usually wrong. Does that match your experience as well?
It really does.
I mean, weird ideas about where the diaphragm is, for example, and the list goes on and on. But
that's absolutely the same experience. And I'm always sort of stunned at how poorly mapped musicians are. And I'm thinking of an example, for example, how the lower arm rotates, how the wrist rotates. And, of course, the most efficient way for the lower arm to rotate is with the ulna side, that is the pinky finger side bone being stationary.
Right.
And the radial side, that is the thumb side, sweeping over. And I would say 60% or more of the pianists that come to me for Alexander lessons, when I just ask them to rotate their wrists, they do it just the opposite. They do it trying to hold that thumb into place as they rotate their hands. And of course, very often they've come to me because they've had severe lack of coordination or tendonitis in the elbow. And as you see, this it's not a mystery why they're having these problems, And so they're just terribly mismapped. And I'm laughing because when you're talking about singers, I teach at the American Musical Dramatic Academy. I teach to a lot of actors, not instrumentalists, but actors and singers and dancers and musical theater majors. So lots of people that study singing. And it's just amazing to me, even after they've had tons of voice lessons and lots of voice work there at the school, where they still come in thinking the diaphragm moves backward and forward instead of up and down. I mean, it's just sort of stunning to me how you know, how they just don't know. I mean, you could simply just open an anatomy book and clarify so much.
Absolutely. And it is, to me, it's, I guess I would view it as somewhat scandalous that musicians in school aren't taught some of these basic anatomical facts about their bodies, because, and we're not talking medical school anatomy here. We're talking anatomy that really any kindergarten kid could pick up in no time. Very simple stuff, but if you don't know it, it can have quite a negative impact on how you play or sing.
Yeah, huge.
Huge, yeah. And your discussion about the mismapping of the wrist and hand and so on. There are, as I'm sure you've run into, people who actually think the elbow joint is a hinge joint.
Right.
And of course, if you're a violinist or a string player or pretty much any kind of musician, that mismap is deadly, because it'll force you into all sorts of weird contortions in your shoulders and so on. Bill, is there anything that we haven't covered that you, for a musician who's listening to this and maybe is thinking about having Alexander lessons as a result, any sort of final words of encouragement that you would like to give them?
Yeah, sure. I would say that if you're having problems as a musician, problems with your functioning, that is that your technique is getting worse, and or you're having pain, that the Alexander technique can help you immensely. To say that it saved my career as a musician is not being overly dramatic. I would not be playing at all today had it not studied the technique. And even if you perceive that you don't really have any problems as a musician, but you would like to find a huge, vast array of other expressive possibilities in what you have and want to understand the music making process in a very, very clear way, the Alexander technique can help you like nothing else out there. So far as a musician, it's been the greatest, most practical tool I've discovered, without a doubt.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to end our interview.
Okay.
My guest today has been Bill Plake, who's an Alexander Technique teacher, who lives in South Pasadena near Los Angeles. He is not only an Alexander teacher, but he is a musician. He plays saxophone and flute. He works a lot with musicians, and he writes a regular blog which addresses some of the things that we've been talking about. We'll be putting a link to his website by the interview, and you can go to his blog from that. And if you're in the LA area and anything that we've talked about intrigues you, contact Bill through his website. And if you live anywhere else in the world, we'll put a link to a website where you can find a teacher in your area. Bill, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, it was really a pleasure. Thank you for having me.